Okay, this next sutta is Samyutta 35, Sutta 243, and it's a bit of a picture of the life at the Buddha at the time of the Buddha. Got a relationship with the society around Buddha's health problems, and then there's a very good talk by Mahamoggallana. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans at Kapilavastu in Nigrodha's park. Now, on that occasion, a new assembly hall had just been built for the Sakyans of Kapilavastu, and it had not yet been inhabited by any ascetic or Brahmin, or by any human being at all. Then the Sakyans of Kapilavastu approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, a new council hall has just been built for the Sakyans of Kapilavastu, and it has not yet been inhabited by any ascetic or Brahmin, or by any human being at all. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One be the first to use it. When the Blessed One has used it first, then the Sakyans of Kapilavastu will use it afterwards. That will lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time." The Blessed One consented by silence. Then, when the Sakyans understood that the Blessed One had consented, they rose from their seats, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on their right, they went to the new assembly hall. They covered it thoroughly with mats, prepared seats, put out a large water jug, and hung up an oil lamp. Then they approached the Blessed One and informed him of this, adding, "Let the Blessed One come at his own convenience." Then the Blessed One, dressed and taking bowl and robe, went together with the Sangha of Bhikkhus to the new assembly hall. After washing his feet, he entered the hall and sat down against the central pillar facing east. The Bhikkhus too, after washing their feet, entered the hall and sat down against the western wall facing east, with the Blessed One in front of them. The Sakyans of Kapilavastu too, after washing their feet, entered the hall and sat down against the eastern wall facing west, with the Blessed One in front of them. The Blessed One then instructed, exhorted, inspired, and gladdened the Sakyans with a Dhamma talk through much of the night, after which he dismissed them, saying, "The night has passed, Gotamas. You may go at your own convenience." "Yes, Venerable Sir," they replied. Then they rose from their seats, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on their right, they departed. Then, not long after the Sakyans of Kapilavastu had left, the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Mahamoggallana thus, "The Sangha Bhikkhus is free from sloth and torpor, Moggallana. Give a Dhamma talk to the Bhikkhus. My back is aching, so I will stretch it." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Mahamoggallana replied. Then the Blessed One prepared his outer robe, folded in four, and lay down on his right side in the lion's posture, with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and clearly comprehending, after noting in his mind the idea of rising. Thereupon the Venerable Mahamoggallana addressed the Bhikkhus thus, "Friends, Bhikkhus." "Friend," those Bhikkhus replied, "the Venerable Mahamoggallana said this, 'I will teach you, friends, an exposition on the corrupted and the uncorrupted. Listen to it and attend closely. I will speak.'" "Yes, friend," those Bhikkhus replied, "the Venerable Mahamoggallana said this, 'How, friends, is one corrupted? Here, having seen a form with the eye, a Bhikkhu is intent upon a pleasing form and repelled by a displeasing form. He dwells without having set up mindfulness of the body, with a limited mind, and he does not understand, as it really is, that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having heard a sound with the ear, and of course through the nose, tongue, body, having cognized the mental phenomenon with the mind, he is intent upon a pleasing mental phenomenon and repelled by a displeasing mental phenomenon. He dwells without having set up mindfulness of the body, with a limited mind, and he does not understand, as it really is, that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. This is called, friends, a bhikkhu who is corrupted amidst forms cognizable by the eye, corrupted amidst sounds cognizable by the ear, corrupted amidst odors cognizable by the nose, corrupted amidst tastes cognizable by the tongue, corrupted amidst tactile objects cognizable by the body, corrupted amidst mental phenomena cognizable by the mind. When a bhikkhu dwells thus, if Mara approaches him through the eye, Mara gains access to him. Mara gains a hold on him. If Mara approaches him through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body, through the mind, Mara gains access to him. Mara gets a hold on him. Suppose, friends, there is a shed made of reeds or of grass, dried up, desiccated, past its prime. If a man approaches it from the east with a blazing grass torch, or from the west, from the north, from the south, from below, or from above, whichever way he approaches it, the fire gains access to it. The fire gets a hold on it. So too, friends, when a bhikkhu dwells thus, if Mara approaches him through the eye, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body, through the mind, Mara gains access to him. Mara gets a hold on him. When a bhikkhu dwells thus, forms overwhelm him. He does not overwhelm forms. Sounds overwhelm him. He does not overwhelm sounds. Odors overwhelm him. He does not overwhelm odors. Tastes overwhelm him. He does not overwhelm tastes. Tactile objects overwhelm him. He does not overwhelm tactile objects. Mental phenomena overwhelm him. He does not overwhelm mental phenomena. This is called, friends, a bhikkhu who is overwhelmed by forms, overwhelmed by sounds, overwhelmed by odors, overwhelmed by tastes, overwhelmed by tactile objects, overwhelmed by mental phenomena. One who is overwhelmed and who does not overwhelm. Evil, unwholesome states have overwhelmed him, states that defile, that lead to renewed existence, that bring trouble, that result in suffering, and that lead to future birth, aging, and death. It is in this way, friends, that one is corrupted. And how, friends, is one uncorrupted? Here, having seen a form with the eye, a bhikkhu is not intent upon a pleasing form and not repelled by a displeasing form. He dwells, having set up mindfulness of the body, with a measureless mind, and he understands as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having heard a sound with the ear, and of course, cognizing phenomena through nose, tongue, body, having cognized a mental phenomenon with the mind, he is not intent upon a pleasing mental phenomenon and not repelled by a displeasing mental phenomenon. He dwells, having set up mindfulness of the body, with a measureless mind, and he understands as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. This is called, friends, a bhikkhu who is uncorrupted amidst forms cognizable by the eye, uncorrupted amidst sounds cognizable by the ear, uncorrupted amidst odors cognizable by the nose, uncorrupted amidst tastes cognizable by the tongue, uncorrupted amidst tactile objects cognizable by the body, uncorrupted amidst mental phenomena cognizable by the mind. When a bhikkhu dwells thus, if Mara approaches him through the eye, Mara fails to gain access to him. Mara fails to get a hold on him. If Mara approaches him through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body, through the mind, Mara fails to gain access to him. Mara fails to get a hold on him. Suppose, friends, there is a peaked house or a hall built of thickly packed clay and freshly plastered. If a man approaches it from the east with a blazing grass torch, or from the west, from the north, from the south, from below, or from above, whichever way he approaches it, the fire fails to gain access to it. The fire fails to get a hold on it. So too, friends, when a bhikkhu dwells thus, if Mara approaches him through the eye, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body, through the mind, Mara fails to gain access to him. Mara fails to get a hold on him. When a bhikkhu dwells thus, he overwhelms forms. Forms do not overwhelm him. He overwhelms sounds. Sounds do not overwhelm him. He overwhelms odors. Odors do not overwhelm him. He overwhelms tastes. Tastes do not overwhelm him. He overwhelms tactile objects. Tactile objects do not overwhelm him. He overwhelms mental phenomena. Mental phenomena do not overwhelm him. This is called, friends, a bhikkhu who overwhelms forms, who overwhelms sounds, who overwhelms odors, who overwhelms tastes, who overwhelms tactile objects, who overwhelms mental phenomena. One who overwhelms and who is not overwhelmed. He has overwhelmed those evil, unwholesome states that defile, that lead to renewed existence, that bring trouble, that result in suffering, and that lead to future birth, aging, and death. It is in this way, friends, that one is uncorrupted. Then the Blessed One got up and addressed the Venerable Mahamoggallana thus, "Good, good Moggallana, you have spoken well to the bhikkhus, the exposition on the corrupted and the uncorrupted." This is what the Venerable Mahamoggallana said. The teacher approved, elated, those bhikkhus delighted in the Venerable Mahamoggallana's statement.
It seems that the way Mahamoggallana is defining uncorrupted requires that one be an arahant.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that...
You may as well go for the whole schmear,
So... The implication is that as long as one is not an arahant, that one's overwhelmed by form, overwhelmed by...
To the extent that one still is following likes and dislikes and still allowing the states of mind that that bring up moods of pleasure, displeasure, that one gives rein to them.
But it sounds like he's not sort of giving an allowance for someone who's sort of trying to train
themselves
and practicing mindfulness.
Well, I think there's different ways that one is teaching, in the sense of you want to sort of kind of encourage and coddle and give a bit of a warm and fuzzy feeling of you're doing okay. And at other times, you want to sort of give a glimpse of what's actually really possible. And I think Mahamoggallana is doing that in that case and saying, this is really possible. This is not, don't settle for second best. Yeah.
Preparations for the seven factors, listening to Bhante Ji.
Uh-huh.
He pointed out like mindfulness. So when you establish mindfulness, it's not a waking factor until it's continuous.
Right.
And then he says before that.
Well, it's sort of before that. It's sort of like that how the similar to how the Buddha says, like with rebirth, when you toss up a stick, it's really not sure which end of the stick it's going to land. So. In the same way that we establish mindfulness and we lose it. And so that it's that re-establishing and reconnecting with that power of mindfulness that again it sort of gives that glimpse of one, that sense of confidence, this is possible, and then two, opening up the opportunity for reaping the fruits of that as well.
Just had a discussion with my Kambodha earlier. Suttas, which I really like, you referred to it after contact, then there's a sprinkling of delight. Yeah,
uh-huh.
Right.
Is it ever clear what kind of back condition the Buddha had when he used it?
Sore. Yeah, I mean, he's getting older. He's getting older. I mean, he's probably reaping the fruits of his kind of ascetic practices. He wasn't that sort of attentive to his body. He's really kind of overwhelming the body with energy and vigor. And it comes home after a while. Okay. So the next sutta is the same Salayatana, Sanyutta 35, Sutta 246. And this is a sutta that brings both the ayatanas and the khandhas together in the same sutta. Bhikkhus, if in any bhikkhu or bhikkhuni desire or lust or hatred or delusion or aversion of mind should arise in regard to forms cognizable by the eye, such a one should rein in the mind from them thus. This path is fearful, dangerous, strewn with thorns, covered by jungle, a deviant path, an evil path, a way beset by scarcity. This is a path followed by inferior people. It is not a path followed by superior people. This is not for you. In this way, the mind should be reined in from these states regarding forms cognizable by the eye. So too, regarding sounds cognizable by the ear and odors, taste, tactile objects, regarding mental phenomena cognizable by the mind. Suppose, bhikkhus, that the barley has ripened and the watchman is negligent. If a bull fond of barley enters the barley field, he might indulge himself as much as he likes. So too, bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling who does not exercise restraint over the six bases for contact indulges himself as much as he likes in the five chords of sensual pleasure. Suppose, bhikkhus, that the barley has ripened and the watchman is vigilant. If a bull fond of barley enters the barley field, the watchman would catch hold of him firmly by the muzzle. While holding him firmly by the muzzle, he would get a secure grip on the locks between his horns, and keeping him in check there would give him a sound beating with his staff. After giving him that beating, he would drive the bull away. This might happen a second and a third time. Thus that bull, fond of barley, whether he has gone to the village or the forest, whether he is accustomed to standing or to sitting, remembering the previous beating he got from the staff, would not enter that barley field again. So too, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu's mind has been subdued, well subdued, regarding the six bases for contact, it then becomes inwardly steady, settled, unified, and concentrated. Suppose, bhikkhus, there was a king or a royal minister who had never before heard the sound of a lute. He might hear the sound of a lute and say, "Good man, what is making this sound? So tantalizing, so lovely, so intoxicating, so entrancing, so enthralling." They would say to him, "Sire, it is the lute that is making this sound. So tantalizing, so lovely, so intoxicating, so entrancing, so enthralling." He would reply, "Go, man, bring me that lute." They would bring him the lute and tell him, "Sire, this is that lute, the sound of which was so tantalizing, so lovely, so intoxicating, so entrancing, so enthralling." The king would say, "I've had enough with this lute, man. Bring me just that sound." The men would reply, "This lute, sire, consists of numerous components, of a great many components, and it gives off a sound when it is played upon with its numerous components, that is, independence on the parchment sounding board, the belly, the arm, the head, the strings, the plectrum, and the appropriate effort of the musician. So it is, sire, that this lute, consisting of numerous components, of a great many components, gives off a sound when it is played upon with its numerous components." The king would split the loot into 10 or 100 pieces, then he would reduce these to splinters. Having reduced them to splinters, he would burn them in a fire and reduce them to ashes. And he would winnow the ashes in a strong wind or let them be carried away by the swift current of a river. Then he would say, "A poor thing indeed, sir, is this so-called loot, as well as anything else called the loot. How the multitude are utterly, utterly heedless about it, utterly taken in by it." So too bhikkhus. A bhikkhu investigates form to the extent that there is a range for form. He investigates feeling to the extent that there is a range for feeling. He investigates perception to the extent that there is a range for perception. He investigates volitional formations to the extent that there is a range for volitional formations. He investigates consciousness to the extent that there is a range for consciousness. As he investigates form to the extent that there is a range for form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, to the extent that there is a range for consciousness, whatever notions of I or mine or I am had occurred to him before, no longer occur to him. So, kind of beautiful sutta and simile.
I'm sort of a jump inside. What's the reason why he became unhappy with the loot and decided to?
Well, it's like he's wanting that sound, rather and thinking that the sound should be something solid and tangible, extractable. From the components of the loot. In the same way that we make the assumption that this feeling of I am mine and I am is something extractable from the and stands alone apart from the components of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, or something that stands apart from eye, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, and it's like this experience of I or I am or mine. And of course that's a classic definition of what the soul is. It's, you know, something that is somehow mystically residing in or part of or apart from or somehow transmogrified within it. Just by making that comparison in the same way, that's the king is going to, I don't want all this extra stuff, I just want the sound. And he said, well, you know, because that's so much of what spiritual aspiration is, I don't want all this other stuff. I just want eternal life. I want to reside in paradise. No, it doesn't work that way. This is what life is.
Yeah. That phrase, to the extent that there is a range for it, does that just mean everything that you might experience in tangents, or something more than that?
I don't think it has anything more than that, in the sense that one is, it's just what one experiences, both in terms of the actual experience, as well as the range, because the range is also one's conceptualizing of it, one's projections, one's ideas about it, as well as the actual experience. Well, I think the one is that it's interesting that when it says, it's being subdued, well subdued, it's not that one is trying to beat consciousness into it, or But that one is willing to keep coming back to sense restraint. I mean, the classic definition of sense restraint. Not getting caught up in the signs and features, not following the aspects of like and dislike, to be willing to keep coming back to that quality of sense restraint, to be able to come back to the quality, to say those qualities of, say, contentment, aspects of contentment, aspects of, so that's a, to me, I think is, and because and again, how the Buddha places it, you know, when the mind has been subdued, well subdued, that sense of bringing it within the range of mindfulness and clear comprehension, then it then becomes inwardly steady, settled, unified, and concentrated, and that turning towards what's conducive to serenity and clarity.
I thought about a good idea of that too, was Siriyogapa. Is that your
That's a good.
You have the past actions that led you towards ill effects, and so then I don't do this
anymore. Yeah, that's a very good that sense of Siriyogapa and that sense of been there, done that. I know where this is going, and then bringing the mind back. Okay, one last sutta, and this is a very well known sutta, but I couldn't help but read it. This is Sunyutta 35, 247. Because suppose a man with limbs wounded or festering would enter a wood of thorny reeds, and the kusa thorns would prick his feet, and the reed blades would slash his limbs. Thus that man would thereby experience even more pain and displeasure. So too, bhikkhus. Some bhikkhu here, gone to the village or the forest, meets someone who reproaches him thus. This venerable one, acting in such a way, behaving in such a way, is a foul village thorn. Having understood him thus as a thorn, one should understand restraint and non-restraint. And how, bhikkhus, is there non-restraint? Here, having seen a form with the eye, a bhikkhu is intent upon a pleasing form and repelled by a displeasing form. He dwells without having set up mindfulness of the body with a limited mind, and he does not understand as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having heard a sound with the ear, and then through nose, tongue, body, having cognized a mental phenomenon with the mind, he is intent upon a pleasing mental phenomenon and repelled by a displeasing mental phenomenon. He dwells without having set up mindfulness of the body with a limited mind, and he does not understand as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil unwholesome states cease without remainder. Suppose, bhikkhus, a man would catch 6 animals with different domains and different feeding grounds and tie them by a strong rope. He would catch a snake, a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a jackal, and a monkey, and tie each by a strong rope. Having done so, he would tie the ropes together with a knot in the middle and release them. Then those 6 animals with different domains and different feeding grounds would each pull in the direction of its own feeding ground and domain. The snake would pull one way thinking, "Let me enter an anthill." The crocodile would pull another way thinking, "Let me enter the water." The bird would pull another way thinking, "Let me fly up into the sky." The dog would pull another way thinking, "Let me enter a village." The jackal would pull another way thinking, "Let me enter a charnel ground." The monkey would pull another way thinking, "Let me enter a forest." Now, when these 6 animals became worn out and fatigued, they would be dominated by the one among them that was the strongest. They would submit to it and come under its control. So too, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has not developed and cultivated mindfulness directed to the body, the eye pulls in the direction of agreeable forms and disagreeable forms are repulsive. The ear pulls in the direction of agreeable sounds and disagreeable sounds are repulsive. The nose pulls in the direction of agreeable odors and disagreeable odors are repulsive. The tongue pulls in the direction of agreeable tastes and disagreeable tastes are repulsive. The body pulls in the direction of agreeable tactile objects and disagreeable tactile objects are repulsive. The mind pulls in the direction of agreeable mental phenomena and disagreeable mental phenomena are repulsive. It is in such a way that there is non-restraint. And how, bhikkhus, is there restraint? Here, having seen a form with the eye, a bhikkhu is not intent upon a pleasing form and not repelled by a displeasing form. He dwells, having set up mindfulness of the body, with a measureless mind, and he understands as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having heard a sound with the ear and through the nose, tongue, body, mind, having cognized a mental phenomenon with the mind, he is not intent upon a pleasing mental phenomenon and not repelled by a displeasing mental phenomenon. He dwells, having set up mindfulness of the body with a measureless mind, and he understands as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil unwholesome states cease without remainder. It is in such a way that there is restraint. Suppose, bhikkhus, a man would catch six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds and tie them by a strong rope. He would catch a snake, a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a jackal, and a monkey and tie each by a strong rope. Having done so, he would bind them to a strong post or pillar. Then those six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds would each pull in the direction of its own ground and domain. The snake would pull one way, thinking, "Let me enter an anthill." The crocodile would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter the water." The bird would pull another way, thinking, "Let me fly up into the sky." The dog would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter a village." The jackal would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter a charnel ground." The monkey would pull another way, thinking, "Let me enter a forest." Now, when these six animals become worn out and fatigued, they would stand close to that post or pillar. They would sit down there. They would lie down there. So too, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has developed and cultivated mindfulness directed to the body, the eye does not pull in the direction of agreeable forms, nor are disagreeable forms repulsive. The ear does not pull in the direction of agreeable sounds, nor are disagreeable sounds repulsive. The nose does not pull in the direction of agreeable odors, nor are disagreeable odors repulsive. The tongue does not pull in the direction of agreeable tastes, nor are disagreeable tastes repulsive. The body does not pull in the direction of agreeable tactile objects, nor are disagreeable tactile objects repulsive. The mind does not pull in the direction of agreeable mental phenomena, nor are disagreeable mental phenomena repulsive. It is in such a way that there is restraint. A strong post or pillar, this bhikkhus, is a designation for mindfulness directed to the body. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We will develop and cultivate mindfulness directed to the body, make it our vehicle, make it our basis, stabilize it, exercise ourselves in it, and fully perfect it. Thus should you train yourselves. So, any questions? That's an oldie but a goodie. This would be, that's the last reading on the sense bases, and next after the one prat, then we'll start on the Bhojangas, the seven factors of enlightenment, and Ajahn Jodhi Paulo has been working on that, develop pulling together some readings, and so he'll be taking that up. There's one sutta that I didn't get to that I had marked for reading, and it's Majjhima 105. It's a very powerful sutta with the ayatanas as a foundation. It was it was a sutta given to Sunakata, who later left the robes. He disrobed and disparaged the Buddha. There's a, I can't remember which, it's another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya that after Sunakata has left and the Buddha is dealing with the his kind of slanderous talk. But anyway, this one, Majjhima 105, I thought it was very interesting, good sutta. If anybody wants to follow up on that one on their own. Okay, so quietly for a bit.